Father, thank you for the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Thank you that we can say from the depths of our heart that he is truly the one who is worthy. Worthy to receive the highest praise of heaven and willing to receive the humblest praise of our hearts. I pray that as we see you, the great God of creation, that we would also be filled with the remembrance that you are the great God of redemption. You are not only the God of the first creation of the physical universe, but that you do not abandon what you've made, and you call us into a living relationship with you through our Lord Jesus. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable to you. We also entrust to you in a special way those who know special grief at this time. Lisa and the children and the Hopkins family, we entrust to you. Others who are passing through the valley of the shadow of death, the Karp family and others, we entrust them to you and thank you for the sufficiency of your grace. In Christ's name. Jacques Monod was a French biochemist, the head of the prestigious Pasteur Institute, man who shared the Nobel Prize in 1965 for his work in the discovery of RNA. He also was the author of a book called Chance and Necessity, in which he took his understanding of life that was necessitated by his view of evolution and put it forward. His understanding is that life and evolution are directed by chance and by natural law, but of the two, chance is the far more powerful player. So he says, when life appeared on the earth, what before the event were the chances it would occur? And on a priori basis, virtually zero. This idea, he then goes on to say, is distasteful to scientists. His view then is that life, human life, but all life is, well, he uses the term a cosmic fluke, a kind of a strange outcome of a blind lottery of cosmic chances, a quirk of fate. And so he ends his book in a couple of sentences that have become rather well known and often quoted. The ancient covenant is in pieces. Man at last knows he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. Neither his destiny nor his duty have been written down, the kingdom above or the darkness below. It is for him to choose. But you need to understand the choice is arbitrary because there's no meaning beyond whatever we might choose. Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvard paleontologist, perhaps the leading evolutionist in the United States, at least in terms of the media, basically agrees. He writes this in a book he, rather to me ironically, entitles Life's Grandeur. We are glorious accidents of an unpredictable process with no drive to complexity, not the expected results of evolutionary principles that yearn to produce a creature capable of understanding the mode of its own necessary construction. Cosmic fluke or glorious accident. Christian de Dewey, a Belgian cell biologist who also won the Nobel Prize in 1974, disagrees. We're not cosmic flukes. We're not glorious accidents. We are, in effect, the inevitable product of natural law. It was almost determined that we would exist just because of the nature of reality, not because there is a God. He has written a book entitled Vital Dust, and his picture is of the universe as a hotbed of life in which we are inevitable. If you can follow, let me quote this. In this organic cloud of carbon compounds which pervades the universe, life is almost bound to arise in a molecular form not very different from its form on Earth, wherever physical conditions are similar to those that prevailed on our planet some 4 billion years ago. The conclusion seems to me almost inescapable. Those who claim that life is a highly improbable event, possibly unique, have not looked closely enough at the chemical realities underlying the origin of life. Life is either a reproducible, almost commonplace manifestation of matter, given certain conditions, or a miracle. Too many steps are involved to allow for something in between. But the rest of his book is designed to say we're not a miracle. We are a commonplace manifestation of natural law. Those are kind of two polar views within the scientific community. One is that we're a glorious accident. The other is that we are an inevitable part of natural law, natural process. And within those boundaries, the Bible emphatically disagrees with both. That we're not a glorious accident. We're not a cosmic fluke. We are the product of the plan and mind and skill and hand of the living God. We are here because He purposed us to be here. We are not the inevitable products of a natural process. We are, as Christian Duduvet gave us the other option, a miracle. We are here because God, in His love and His wisdom and His skill and His understanding, purposed that we be here. Now, obviously, the way in which we view our origins, the way we view our existence, has a tremendous significance in terms of how we live our life. If we're a cosmic fluke, if we're a glorious accident, that is one thing. If we are in the inevitable part of matter and law, that is another. But if we are creatures who come from the hand of God, placed here as the end result of His planning and purpose and process, then all of life looks different. And we need to see ourselves as God would have us see ourselves. Genesis 1 is not written primarily to answer some of our interesting and sometimes even significant scientific questions. It's not that it doesn't give us a framework in which to answer those, but the Bible presses us to personal questions, ultimate questions about who God is, about who we are, about what the purpose of life is. We read Genesis 1 and it comes to us as a kind of simple outline sketch of how things came into being. It doesn't concern itself with either the origins on one side of amoeba and bacteria or the origins and the life cycle of dinosaurs. Those aren't within the framework of what Genesis 1 is concerned about. It is concerned to give us a picture of the living God and His purposes and His character for us. Now, I'd like you to take your Bibles and turn back to Genesis chapter 1. And we're coming to verse 14 of chapter 1 this morning as we're working our way through these early chapters, and we're calling them Understanding Life. And it's especially as we move to the end of the message this morning, and then from next week on, we're going to be dealing with material that is highly relevant to the way we live our lives day after day. But even these early verses give us a framework of thinking about God, about life, about nature, about existence that is utterly crucial to living as God would have us live. Let's read the first two verses, Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, and then we'll go to verse 14. In the beginning, we read, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Let me pause there for a minute. There are three things that I've tried to say to you about Genesis that become very important to getting an overview of our understanding of what is going on in this passage. Some of it flows out of these verses. The first is, this is a chapter that is very carefully structured, and it's structured around verse 2. And those early words of verse 2. Now the earth was without form and empty. It was formless and empty. In day 1, day 2, day 3, we are going to see God taking this unformed creation and forming it. So day 1, He forms the lights. In day 2, He forms the atmosphere. In day 3, He forms the sea and the sky. Day 4, 5, and 6, which we're going to look at this morning, the emphasis is on filling. God is filling the empty. And as God forms the formless, now God fills the empty. And He fills in parallel. Day 1, He formed the light. Day 4, He forms the lights. Day 5, He formed the atmosphere. In day 5, He fills the atmosphere. In day three, He forms the sky and the sea. In day two, He forms the waters and the coming together of the waters above and the waters below, so the atmosphere. So then we have fish and birds, and then day three is the forming of the dry land, in day six is the filling of the dry land with animals and with man. Now, as you begin to see, this is carefully structured. It is given as a kind of highly rememberable, even though I just got it wrong or didn't get it clear in my own mind, way of thinking about creation. It is both, in one sense, chronological, but it is also topical. It isn't designed to give us everything in detail. It is to give us the picture in broad strokes of the way God is proceeding. Second thing I want you to notice about this is that it is a message that is given for a very distinctive purpose. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It was given to the nation of Israel, who just come out of Egypt. They're at Mount Sinai. They're an unformed people. They're going to a land that isn't their land. And God has promised to form them as a nation and to fill them with blessing in the land which he's going to give. But they need to know about the character of God. Their great need wasn't to know about how everything came into existence. Their great need was to know, who is God and how does he work? They came out of Egypt with all of these ideas that had come to them from the Egyptians or from the Canaanites or from Mesopotamia, all of the ideas of the ancient Near East. But they needed to know God. So what do they learn about God? If you get these ideas, you'll understand chapter 1. Who is God? God is a God who brings light out of darkness. Who is God? God is a God who brings order out of chaos. Who is God? God is a God who brings life and fullness out of emptiness. Now that's what they needed to hear, and that's what I need to hear. I need to hear that God is a God who shines into the darkness of my life and brings light. That God is a God who moves into the chaos and the disorder of my life, the formlessness of my life, and brings order and beauty and structure. I need to know that God is a God who moves into the emptiness of my life and brings life and brings fullness. That he takes those things, and that's the God that we're introduced to in this chapter. The God who not only did creation, but the God who does creating. Who always works on these principles. Now the third thing about this, the structure is given, this is a kind of chronological, topical setting forth of the great movement of God in creation. It is designed primarily to show us about God, and the third thing is that it is an attack on pagan ideas of God. False ideas of God that mislead us and move us in the wrong direction. We're going to see that in a rather straightforward way this morning. So let's read verse 14. Day 4. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky. Let me translate that really literally because you'll see it does have some significance. Let the lights in the expanse of the sky, or let the luminaries in the expanse of the sky, separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Interesting that the fourth day is given more space than any other day except the sixth day. There's something very important that is going on here. Now, I want you to just think with me and track with me a little bit. There's a kind of interesting problem that develops as we get to verse 14 when God says, let the luminaries in the sky give light. On Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, we read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the heavens refer to all that's there. So in day 1, at the very beginning of this action, we have God calling into existence the whole cosmos. The sun, the stars, all of those are clearly in place in verse 1. In the beginning, God made everything. Then in verse 3, we have God saying, let there be light. So what we have in verse 1 is the existence of the whole array of the heavens, the sun and the stars, as well as the earth. And then we have in verse 3 the existence of light, although we are not told what the source of light is. So what could be meant here in verse 14 when it says, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky, or better, let the lights, or let the luminaries in the expanse of the sky separate the day from the night. Well, one idea is this is when God made the sun and the moon and the stars, and yet that's already taken place in verse 1. And we've already have light in existence. So others suggest this is when God completed the sun and the stars, that somehow he turned them on at this particular point. And yet that is hard to try and put in place as well, that they existed, but now they become gaseous things giving off light and giving off heat. So another way of understanding it is to say in some way, and that's why I read it as you did, the Hebrew text is quite interesting here. It does not say, let there be lights. It says, let the luminaries, let the lights in the expanse of the sky. The word lights is a word that actually is not the normal Hebrew word for light. It means a luminary or a light bearer. Every other time it's used of the lampstand in the temple or in the tabernacle in the Old Testament, something that holds a light rather than something that is in itself a light, but that's a technical thing. But it says, let the luminaries in the skies separate. Let me make sure I'm reading this right. Separate the day from the night. In other words, they are already there. But now they begin to have this particular function. My understanding of this is, and I need to tell you, it is not something that is absolutely clear, but Moses is not making a mistake here. The point is that the light in some way, the light source was veiled in verse 3, kind of like yesterday in the Inland Empire where you didn't see the sun all day, but there was light here. You know, we get these things in this time of year where light is diffused, but the light source cannot be seen. And that apparently is what happens, that now the sun and the moon and the stars become visible from Earth. Hugh Ross makes this suggestion, and it is only a suggestion, and these kind of things, as we try and take what we know of science and apply them to the Bible, always need to be done with humility, because we just don't know whether this is the case, but it seems like a credible suggestion when he writes, certain atmospheric constituents, along with air temperature, pressure, and humidity, would have prevented any break in the cloud cover on Earth. Volcanic activity may also have contributed to this permanently overcast condition. The carbon dioxide level was substantially higher than the current level, contributing to high humidity. Through time, changes in these various environmental factors would have brought about major transformation of the atmosphere, this time from translucent to transparent, which is saying it isn't simply that light gets through, but now the kind of mist and cloud vanish, and the sun and the moon and the stars are visible from planet Earth as distinct and viable entities. He also suggests that this is related to the slowing down of the rotation of the Earth and the dispelling of Earth the cloud cover and things related to that. All of that is kind of scientific guessing about what may be going on here. What we do know is that now at this time on day 4, the sun and the moon and the stars become visible, and they are given three functions by God. So notice, and this is repeated, it is viewed as so important. Let there be lights or let the luminaries and the expanse of the sky separate day from night. So it functions in terms of illumination. A little further on in the text, it says, let them give light on the earth. And then the second function is regulation or separation, separating the night from day. And later on it uses the term to rule, to govern, verse 18, the day and the night. And then the third is as a sign. Let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. So now, and we've known this all through human history, it isn't simply that we have day and night and the establishment of the calendar and the regular Earth cycle as we know it at this particular time of day and night and moon and month following on that, but we have months and we have years, and we have the calculation in the Old Testament on the basis of the moon and its phases of the various ceremonies and festivals and religious activities of that time. But more than that, they are set there as signs. The heavens declare the glory of God. And they are signs not only of seasons, but they are signs of the power and greatness and majesty of God. Imagine you're in a foreign country and you're traveling down the road and all of a sudden you turn to a friend and tell me about that sign. And he looks back to you and says, well, it's a neon sign and electricity comes through the filament in a vacuum tube, and as it goes through the vacuum, it discharges, breaks down electrons into positive and negative ions, and they go in different directions, and all of a sudden a little girl in the back seat pipes up her voice, says, no, Daddy, what that sign says is if you drive in there, Ronald McDonald will give us a Happy Meal. Now you ask the question, who is more correct? Well, the answer is, if you want the question of how the sun and the moon and the stars work, you listen to what that man says about the way in which a neon sign works. But if you want to know what they mean, you listen to what the little girl says about the fact they're pointers to something, they're telling us something, they have a message to give us. And that is what God is doing, to give us the panorama of the stars and the sun and the moon as a reminder. But there's something else here. This is not just God turning on the lights. There's a certain sense in which this is Moses turning off the myths. See, the ancients lived in a world full of the worship of the sun and the moon and the stars. They'd just come out of Egypt, the Israelites had, and all around them they had seen the great Egyptian god Re, reminder of the sun. They're going into Egypt, into Canaan. And in Canaan, the very first city they're going to go into is called Jericho. Name for moon is Yerach. Jericho was a city of moon worshippers. Abraham, his father, had been named Terah after Yerah, the moon god. There is a city not far away, a city where ultimately, from Jericho that is, where ultimately King Saul is going to have his body impaled against a wall, and that city is named Beth Shemesh, the house of the sun, Shemesh meaning sun. The whole area was full of the worship of the sun and the moon and the stars. You turn to our papers today, and what do you discover? You discover the astrology section. Most read part of any newspaper in the year 2000 is the astrology column. We are here on Sunday. Tomorrow is Monday. We go through all of these things, and we're reminded about how powerful the influence of the stars and the sun and the moon have been upon people in their understanding of life. And these people had a need. They were driven by fear and superstition about these heavenly powers who were not simply creatures. They were creatures. They were living things that exerted power. We have had people in the White House making decisions by consulting an astrologer, determining the president's timetable on the basis of that. So this is not entirely a foreign world. But what is Moses telling the people of Israel? He is telling the people of Israel, these things which others worship are the handiwork of God. They're pointers to the glory of God. We do not serve them. They serve us. They tell us the seasons. They separate day and night for us. They are put there to serve us, not for us to serve them. Did you notice something very interesting in verse 16? God made two great lights. The greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. Now, he's also talking about this from an earth perspective, but you notice he doesn't even name the sun and the moon. He deliberately avoids naming them because others worship them. He wants them to know, these are just lights, one's bigger than the other. I'm not even going to give them names. And then notice the end of the phrase. He also made the stars. You know what you worship? Yeah, God threw those in too. And we stand in wonder as we think about the billions of stars and galaxies and things that astronomers tell us about, and it's an afterthought in the passage. Oh yeah, God also made those. Point he is trying to say is, don't fall in worship before the lights. They are light bearers, but God is the light. Oh, not in a physical sense. But all the sun and the moon perform are ways in which God provides light for earth. But as Jesus said, I am the light of the world. Comes after me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Moses wants them to understand there is no other source of life. The next day, day five, God has filled the heavens now with lights as he's preparing for man. Day five, God said, verse 20, let the water teem with living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the water in the sea, in the seas, let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. Now, the first part of this is God creating animate life. We've had vegetation, we've had the earth, we've had the shaping of all of these things. Now God is speaking animate life into existence. And his first act is, as we have here, filling the seas, let the water teem with living creatures. Literally, it says, let the water swarm with swarmers. And you think of the abundance of life that we continue to discover in the oceans and in the waters of our world. And then they are specified more specifically in verse 21. So God created the great creatures of the sea. We'll come back to that in a minute. But we're thinking here of perhaps whales and sharks and crocodiles and those kind of great creatures. And every living and moving thing. Everyone that has, literally the phrase is now used for the first time, the breath of life, or a living soul. And animals and fish are said as here being creatures that have the soul of life, the breath of life. This is now living beings that move in a way that vegetation doesn't move. And then on the other side of that, we have the birds. Let birds fly above the earth, cross the expanse of the heaven. And we're told that every winged bird is created according to its kind. And then God does something he's not done before. We're told in verse 22, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth in the sea, fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. That God blesses what he has made, and he blesses it by creating fertility. So two things are said here. Something about the abundance. Life is created in abundance, and life is created in stability. Phrase occurs that they reproduce after their kind. Now, that's not related to our modern biological terms. There is room here to recognize all kinds of variation and adaptation within some boundaries that God has given. But there's a stability to the life that God is calling into order. Behind that, though, stands something else. And I want to focus your attention on verse 21. Verse 21, we read, so God created. This is only the second time in all of this chapter we've had this word. In the beginning, God created. Bara is the Hebrew word. Now we read, and God created. Bara. The next time we're going to have it is in verse 27, and it's going to be used there three times. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Now, bara is used in Hebrew language for something only God does. And he does it in bringing into being something new. And the question is, why does he use this word for the great sea monsters or the great sea creatures at this particular point? Obviously, he's bringing into being something new. This is life on a new scale. This is life on a new kind. But there's behind that another significance. God created the great sea creatures. Why? Well, if you know something about the ancient Near East, you know that in every nation in the ancient Near East, there's a great myth. And the great myth behind it is of a great sea monster, a great sea dragon, who's the source of creation. The hero gods are born from this sea monster who gives birth to them. The sea monster lives in Yam, the sea, and the sea is another monster. And then one of the gods rises up, kills the sea monster, and in some myths, in other ways, continually struggles, but the sea monster doesn't die. She gives birth to other rebel monsters. And in one myth, one of the oldest ones, the sea monster is killed, cut in half, and her two pieces are spread apart, and that's where the sky comes from. Now, the reason I'm giving you that is not so that you will look back and think, what a silly idea. The idea is that here is the religious viewpoint that dominated the ancient Near East, of a sea monster, about gods who were in constant conflict with one another. Baal was the god who helped defeat the sea monster in Canaan. And so Baal, or Baal, is going to be the god the Israelites are going to meet over and over and over. And here's the great sea monster, Tanin. And it was viewed as, you know, we have the Loch Ness monster, or we have this. But this passage says simply, God created the great sea creatures. They're not rivals to God. They're not monsters that threaten God. Now, whether we're talking about whales, or whether we're talking about crocodiles, whether we're talking about these creatures of the sea, which for people who lived on land like the Israelites did, caused wonder and fear and awe, and in the nations around caused dread and superstition, who you imitated in worship. The gods were different in degree, but not in kind, and so they involved in sexual activity and battles and killing and lust and all of those other activities, and you imitated them in worship. And Moses is saying, as clearly as can be said, that they are creatures of God. God made them. There's no hope in pagan myths. They're God's creation. That's not our world. We don't live in a world full of superstition and fear, or maybe we do in some ways. But we need to understand in the same way that we're creatures of God. We're not like them. When our child gets sick, we don't go to the temple, we go to the doctor. When our crops die, we don't pray for fertility and go to the temple and go through orgies. We irrigate and we fertilize. When we're hot or we're cold, we turn on the heat or turn on the air conditioning. And yet, we begin to realize, even in the midst of that, we can't control what we set in motion. All of these things which we are blessed with in terms of modern technology begin to run away from us. And we begin to recognize that at the same time we've subdued the earth and brought it under control in terms of providing heat and providing cold, we're polluting our environment, putting ourselves at risk in terms of future generations. And we think of all of the blessings that technology is bringing, but we also have within our society this pervasive sense that something's wrong. When we were in Calgary last week, the World Petroleum Congress was meeting there, and they had brought in all kinds of police because they were afraid there was going to be the same kind of riots that took place in Seattle in Calgary, and they had been setting up for this World Congress, and protesters had been training. I haven't heard of anything that happened, but then again, news doesn't always cross the border in terms of what might have happened up there. But the recognition, here we are, and there's the World Petroleum Congress with all of these accomplishments, and yet we say, it's provided all of this, and yet something's wrong. And it's only God who fills the empty. It's only God who ultimately provides the needs. And that's what Moses is trying to say in a world very different from ours. Well, let's look at day six. God is the God who fills the land with life. Verse 24, God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds. Livestock, creatures that move along the ground, wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kind, all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. God saw that it was good. Now, it's rather striking, and I want you to notice the phrasing that's used. Let the land produce living creatures. There's kind of an indirection here. Look back up to verse 11. Verse 11, God said, let the land produce vegetation. Verse 12 says, the land produced vegetation. And somehow the land becomes an agent that acts in between here. Here in verse 24, we have, let the land produce living creatures. It doesn't say, let there be living creatures, as he says of, for example, the fish and the birds. It says, let the land produce living creatures. And yet at the same time in verse 25, God made the wild animals according to their kind. And there's all kinds of things that are left open-ended there about particular processes that God has used. And when he describes the animals, he describes them in the broadest path possible categories. But it's in verses 26 and to 31 that the center comes. Let's just notice that. God said, let us make man in our own image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, birds of the air, the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over every living creature that moves on the ground. And we'll stop there in terms of reading. I just want you to notice three things quickly. This is the crown of it all. Everything's been prepared for this moment. Yesterday, my daughter in Phoenix had a couple of baby showers on Friday and Saturday, because in a month we're going to become grandparents again if God so blesses us. And there's something about preparing for the child and getting everything ready. And others join in the enthusiasm. We want to prepare for the baby. And it's as if God is working all through creation to that. Everything is prepared. Everything is ready. The earth has been formed. The earth has been filled. And now he says, let's make man. The first time he speaks deliberately. Let's make man in our own image. And it kind of moves to this grand climax of all of creation. Everything's been prepared for the purpose. And I want you to notice three things this passage is telling us. First of all, we have a special importance. Human beings have a special importance in creation. We are not glorious accidents. We are God's intention. Secondly, we have a special relationship. Animals produce after their kind. Fish and birds produce after their kind. Let us make man in our own image. We're made after the likeness of God in some amazing way. And next week we're going to come back to that. And then we not only have a special importance and a special relationship, we have a special responsibility, a special calling. We represent God as his image. We serve in God's place on planet Earth, representing him and carrying out his mandate in creation and rule creation as his stewards. But the point that we need to see as we step back is this. God is a God who brings light out of darkness. God is a God who brings form out of chaos. God is a God who brings fullness where there's emptiness. That's in Jesus Christ what God longs to do in our life. I am the light of the world. God who shined in the darkness shines in our hearts to bring the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. God is a God who longs to bring order into the unformness of our life and give shape and purpose of meaning. And God is a God who loves to fill the empty with his life. I'm come that you might have life and that you might have it in abundance. Genesis isn't written, as Galileo said a long time ago, to tell us how the heavens go. It's really written to tell us how to go to heaven, or at least how to know the God of heaven. And I want you to think of him in where you are this morning as the God who will bring light into your darkness, form into your chaos, fullness into your empty. Father, thank you that you are the God who does these things. Help us to see you and know you and worship you in that light. And I pray now that as we give, our gifts might bring glory to you. In Christ's name.